Les colloques du Collège de France.
La professeure Shimazu a fait d'abord une carrière internationale, notamment en Angleterre et à Singapour. Et elle s'intéresse entre autres à l'histoire de la diplomatie à l'échelle globale. Je ne trahis pas un secret en disant qu'elle-même est fille de diplomate, donc c'est quelqu'un qui circule beaucoup dans le monde et qui est actuellement donc responsable du Tokyo College, qui est une institution à l'intérieur de l'université de Tokyo, qui elle-même est une institution extrêmement prestigieuse. Et le Tokyo College est un peu une sorte d'institut d'études avancées, et qui se trouve avoir une convention d'échange avec le Collège de France. Donc bienvenue au Collège de France. Alors la professeure Shimazu avait d'abord proposé un titre qui était le « Race and Identity in the Japanese Discourse in the Late 19th and Early 20th Century », c'est-à-dire donc « Race et identité dans le discours japonais » à la fin du 19e et au début du 20e siècle. Et en fait, elle a changé légèrement l'intitulé, qui est devenu Performing Race and Identity, the Japanese and the British Colonial Sphere, c'est-à-dire race et identité en action, les Japonais dans la sphère coloniale britannique.
Thank you very much, Professor Chong, for the invitation to speak at this colloque. And it's a great honor and privilege for me to be here. And I apologize profusely for not being able to speak French enough anyway to give a talk in French. So I hope you'll be patient with me. And also for the inconvenience and the possible confusion caused by the last minute revision of the title of my lecture. And unfortunately came a bit too late to change the program, so I apologize, Professor Chong, and to the audience here. So as the revised title of my paper shows, my story today takes us to Singapore in the late 19th and early 20th century, in the period roughly speaking from 1890 to the 1930s. And the Japanese community which existed there. So I'm going to use this community as a lens through which to think about the issues of race and identity in the Japanese discourse in that period. In more ways than one, the Japanese community in Singapore represented a microcosm of the diverse range of Japanese people from the very low socioeconomic classes to the middle classes, and occasionally a smattering of the upper classes in the British colony. So in what is to follow, I will attempt to demonstrate how race and identity became the two issues which caused tension within the Japanese community, reflecting the larger preoccupations of the public discourse back in Japan. But first, if we could pause here for a moment and think about how race had been debated in the Japanese discourse around the time. Now, it seems that the Japanese had ascribed to the Gobinorian conception of the three races consisting of the white, yellow, and black races, as per the poster image for this conference shows. And it was drawn by Horika Kensai, as you see in the program, a fish to set colloque. And the thing is, as Professor Frank Dikuter mentioned in his lecture, the Chinese had a more varied conception of the race, or what races there were in the world at the time, the five races that he mentioned. But in the Japanese writing of the period, I've actually, maybe once somebody mentioned five, but it's basically based on the three races, sort of. And the interesting thing about this is that if you look at the poster, at the bottom it says, you know, under the white race, it would say the first, and it's actually a ranking. The first class race, sort of, you know. And then under the yellow race, it says the second. And then under the black race, it says the third. So the Japanese ascribed hierarchical ranking of the racial categories that they thought was the dominant sort of understanding of race in their sort of so both the intellectual milieu, but also in the public discourse. And what I also wanted to say, and this is also very relevant to the latest speaker, I think Professor Reggie Meyer is going to be speaking about the Yellow Peril. So the Japanese became very sensitive to the idea of race, or in Japanese it's called jinshu, from the time of about the Sino-Japanese War of 1894 to 95. And it has a lot to do with this one image, which was supposed to have been this sketch made by Kaiser Wilhelm II, known as the Yellow Peril. And I'm sure a lot of you have seen this image before. Now, what I wanted to stress here was how deeply the Japanese resented the application of the term yellow peril. Actually, peril may be less bad than the yellow part, to describe them, because the yellow peril emphasized race through the use of color, i.e. yellow, and the Japanese felt that they could never attain parity with the Western imperial past, no matter what they did, due to the popular understanding at the time that race was an immutable concept. So in the words of one Japanese diplomat around the time, the Yellow Peril had inflicted a, and I quote unquote, permanent damage on the Japanese nation. So henceforth, the Yellow Peril debate, in Japanese known as Kōkaron, as one variant of the racial discourse, which was known as Jinshuron, gained regular usage in Japanese debates on foreign policy, which is known as Taigai Ron, so debates about Japan's external sort of relations. Now, so needless to say, the Yellow Peril had a hugely symbolic impact on the Japanese discourse, and you could even say, even the psyche and the mentality, and was most likely the reason for the turn of a more racially conscious way of carving out Japan's future path in what became known as Pan-Asianism. And this stood in contrast, so this Pan-Asian debate stood in contrast to the more pro-Western debate called Escape Asia, Enter Europe, which dates back to 1885. Now, in 1898, Konoe Atsumaro advocated a solidarity of the same race, so Dōjinshu, Dōmeiron, and because of the prospect of racial rivalry between the white and the yellow races became much more possible. And so note that this very famous idea came up in 1898, 3 years after the the Yellow Peril sketch that was made by the Kaiser. And a year later, in 1899, the idea had already been circulated by Yamagata Aritomo, who was a general, but moreover, a very powerful Meiji oligarch that ruled Japan at the time. And then, in 1908, 4 years after Japan wins the Russo-Japanese War, a prominent Pan-Asian journal called Taiyo, which means the sun in Japanese, dedicated a special issue to the clash of the yellow and white peoples. So what I wanted to make clear here was the difference in how race was understood and debated in Japan as a three-tiered conception, and in Singapore, where the use of race was a category to distinguish one people from another, as we will see. So let's go to the 19th century Singapore. So in the late 19th and early 20th century, Singapore was an important strategic colony of the British Empire, as I'm sure you know, in what was known as the Straits Settlements alongside Malacca and Penang. Initially, the Straits Settlements was known was formed as an administrative unit of the English East India Company in 1826, but later came under the British Colonial Office from 1867. Now, it was a vibrant port city with many different nationalities and communities, including perhaps the lesser-known ones like the Armenians, who established the first Christian church in Singapore on what became Armenian Street, and the Hadhrami Yemenis, who came as traders across the Indian Ocean and settled around what became known as Arab Street, and the Swiss, for example, who were very active in the Straits Settlements as intermediaries between the Dutch East Indies and Europe in trading goods and commodities, for example. Now, after the Meiji Restoration of 1868, the Japanese started coming and settling in Singapore. Now, ordinarily, in this kind of narrative, it is the men who come first and settle in port cities. However, in the case of the Japanese, it was the women. Oh, thank you. That's easier. Thank you so much. Yeah. Right. It was the women who came, and they were mostly sex workers who constituted the early settler group in Singapore, popularly known as Karayuki-san, which means the one who goes to China. That's the Japanese word, the characters used. Now, these women generally came from Kyushu Island, which is the fourth and the last kind of big island in the archipelago. Now, so colonial Singapore was a site of a sprawling sex industry. And while some Japanese women went out there of their own volition, others were trafficked there by a network of Japanese and non-Japanese pimps. And most Karayuki-san lived in brothels concentrated around Malay, Hailam, and Malabar Street, which all these names in Singapore still exist today exactly in the same way, which were collectively referred to as steretsu, which was a corruption of the English word streets. And so these Karayuki-san became the nucleus of a new community in Singapore, and Japanese merchants and professionals set up shops nearby to cater to their needs. Now, this map that you've been gazing at all the time, these are Japanese maps, and this is the area that we are largely talking about. And the steretsu is like the three streets here. So this is Korieki that we will talk about a bit later. And as you see, this is the island of Singapore, and we're talking about this particular little area here. And this is Peninsula Malaya of the time. So by the turn of the century, 20th century, a little Japan developed along Middle Road, which is this red street here. So this is generally known as the Little Japan area. And unsurprisingly, Little Japan developed a rough reputation. There were, apart from the Karayuki-san, there were the brash entertainers, you know, shopkeepers, gregarious restaurateurs, and gangsters, for example. Now, however, because of this, the fact that it was a neatly contained area as such, it sort of became quite a famous site of tourism, for the lack of better term. Part of it was sex tourism, but a lot of it was about curious middle-class travelers who came, and travelers, I mean both Japanese and Western travelers, who would want to come and look at this little Japan and see what it was like, this notorious steretsu area within the little Japan district, and they would stroll through the streets, gawk at the going-ons, and have some food and drinks in Japanese eateries and restaurants in the area, and buy a souvenir or two from Singapore. And so whilst this stream of visitors injected a sense of excitement and energy into the growing Japanese resident community along Middle Road, the neighborhood also had the effect of exposing the Japanese visitors to a cross-section of Japanese society, including sex workers and other occupations considered lowly, to the extent that would not have been common for the respectable classes back in Japan. Now, I'm just wondering the time, really. We are really going on.
10 minutes.
Okay.
Not more.
Yeah, all right. So the thing is, these karaoke-san were actually mostly confined in those small areas, but also they you know, clad kimono all the time. This is why you could distinguish Japanese prostitutes from others. And they had a Japanese hairdo. And they even went close to the passenger piers to see if they could lure customers coming off the boats. So this meant that they became quite visible, at least in the parts around that kind of the quays and so on. And so, you know, you might kind of wonder whether they had been sort of pandering to the Western kind of male fantasy of the Orient, you know, the famous sort of, you know, geishas, as though they were walking out of the pages of Pierre Loti's Madame Chrysanthemums. Now, the problem was that they became a feature of the port city and as a racial stereotype. In other words, in colonial Singapore, racial categories were used to distinguish one ethnicity, nationality to another. So therefore, the Japanese were seen as a distinct race, which meant that the karaoke-san and the low-life people in those areas around the Middle Road and particularly Steretse area were seen to represent Japan. And so this became a really quite a serious problem for the Japanese officialdom in Singapore, mainly because this kind of racial stereotyping of the Japanese as a whole was very damning for the reputation of Japan as an imperial state and the Japanese nation. So what happened was that in 1910, there was quite a big change because of the First World War, there's an economic boom in Japan, and Japan was fighting on the side of the Allied powers. And as a result of this, a lot of middle-class professional businessmen and for example, administrators from Japan would move to Singapore. And sometimes they would come as single men, but other times they would come with families. And as you can imagine, this influx of a new sort of categories of Japanese people changed the makeup of the Japanese community in Singapore, to the extent that these people, when they arrived and they came with the families, they wanted to settle in respectable neighborhoods, and so they didn't live around Middle Road area. They lived sort of much more in the kind of posher suburbs, as well as, you know, they sort of mingled, particularly the elite ones, mingled with the Western society in Singapore. And so these people began to see the Middle Road area, particularly those Steretse bit, as being an incredible eyesore, and not just an eyesore, but causing a massive reputational damage to Japan as a emerging great power at the time. Because at the Paris Peace Conference of 1919, Japan attended the conference as the fifth great power in the world. And there it was, the Japanese were seen in the British colonial sphere of Singapore as represented by the karaoke-san and so on. And these are the kind of postcards that really sold incredibly well in Singapore. And these were taken by Japanese photo studios in the area. Okay, so am I, Anne, am I? Mm-hmm. running out of time.
Just to the conclusion.
Okay, conclusion. Five minutes. Okay. And so these people decided, these sort of respectable society, Japanese, decided that they had to basically abolish prostitution and eliminate this embarrassment of the Japanese race from the Singapore scene. And so they got together with the Japanese consulate, and also in 1917, there was a very sort of fiery, fervent Japanese Presbyterian church minister arrived, someone called Umemori Hideo, and he was, for a different reason, really kind of tormented by the degradations that he saw in the sex industry of the Japanese prostitutes in Singapore. So he became a very fervent anti-prostitution campaigner. And so the sort of the newer respectable class of Japanese and this, for example, this one very fervent minister, they sort of got together and started sort of cleaning up Singapore. So they created lots of different associations, sport clubs for the young, all that, in order to streamline the Japanese society and so on. And then what happens is that in 1920, basically the Japanese Consulate General of Japan manages to make it illegal for prostitution of Japanese sex workers in Singapore. So it was a sort of like a unilateral move made by the Japanese officialdom in Singapore, and not because the British authorities had asked them to do something about it. So I am going to stop here because I've only came half of the story, but I know that we're running out of time, so sorry about this, and just show you the photographs. This is the Sterezi area that you may have been wondering, and the minister in his the Presbyterian church, and these are the kind of pictures of the Japanese consul general, which moved closer and closer to the kind of the major Straits settlements area in Singapore, ending up they occupied this one of the biggest, most kind of famous buildings in Singapore for about 20 years, and then they got pushed in 1939 to this building, but it totally reflects the fortunes of Japan as a great power. And remember that it is actually in British settlement, so colony, which means that Japan, which became an access power, is increasingly unwelcomed in Singapore. So you can see from the move that it now is settling into a house which had been owned by a Japanese dentist by 1939. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, thank you very much to Professor Shimazu for making such an effort, because maybe you don't realize, but because of course, I mean, the Japanese always, you know, have to put up a brave face. I mean, in front of, you know, adversity. But she's been sort of suffering from a bad flu, you know, and so she but she insisted on coming to Paris all the same to talk to us. So really, we're quite grateful. I'll have to speak English so that Professor Shimazu, she reads French, but maybe the oral part is a bit difficult. I think, you know, it was quite salutary for us, I mean, to remember a time when Japan would be associated with a red light district, you know, I mean, sort of prostitutes and, you know, sort of very... and, of course, the case of Japan in the late 19th century reminds us that, you know, the condition of women, you know, who have to emigrate, I mean, is always the same everywhere. You know, you have the same phenomenon happening with the Chinese immigration, you know, fairly recent, when the communist China decided to shut down, you know, all the state industries, you see, like the steel industry, you know, in the Dongbei, meaning the northeast of China, Manchuria, precisely. You know, a lot of Chinese women had to emigrate, and some of them we know to have sort of ended up in France, in Paris, and having to resort to prostitution, I mean, to be able to survive, you know. So that's a sort of a universal element. And the other thing is that we can see in the evolution of urban architecture of Singapore, you know, that Professor Shimazu has just described to us, you see that this effort of Japan as it rose to power, you know, in the first half of the 20th century, to try to join the white club, you know, precisely, I mean, sort of trying to leave behind this sort of belonging to the yellow race, you see, which was still, you know, in the mainstream discourse in the 1870s, you see, as we saw in the poster of the conference. But then trying very hard, I mean, to move out of this, you know, sort of yellow category, you know, which then was reserved for the Chinese. You see, I mean, the Chinese would be pushed down, you know, by Japan. You see, at that time, and the Chinese were yellow, whereas the Japanese were white. You know, so that's a very interesting evolution to observe. And if we just revert very quickly to the slide of that Japanese, the paradox here is that she's sort of labeled as a Japanese lady, you know, you can see that first of all, I mean, the features, the hairdo, and the attitude, you know, is very European. You know, I mean, it reminds you of the representations of La Dame aux Camélias. You know, I mean, you know, sort of rather languid. You know, and so even as a lady of une dame de petite vertu, comme on dit en français, she has this sort of very European, you know, sort of attitude, you know, and trying to pose like a like a European lady, actually, you know. So that's the paradox. You know? Bon, bien. Donc là, je suis obligée de passer très très rapidement donc à la communication suivante pour ne pas vraiment retarder le programme. En tout cas, merci encore à la professeure Shimazu. Et nous avons donc maintenant.
Retrouvez tous les contenus du Collège de France sur www.college-de-france.fr.